I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word Podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word Podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
MSW Media. Hey everybody, it's AG and welcome to Refried Beans, where we play an episode of the Daily Beans podcast from the same week, either 1, 2, or 3 years ago, so we can see how far we've come. So please enjoy this episode from days gone by and note the date in the intro.
Refried beans. I like refried beans. That's why I want to try fried beans, because maybe they're just as good and we're wasting time.
Hello and welcome to the Daily Beans for Friday, March 25th, 2022. Today, the Select Committee on January 6th is in possession of more than 3 months of text messages between Ginny Thomas and Mark Meadows. The 1-6 Committee will vote to hold Scavino and Navarro in criminal contempt. Bannon crafts his defense in the criminal contempt case against him. Donald files a lawsuit against the world. The 1-6 Committee expands its probe into the RNC emails that defrauded donors ahead of the attack on the Capitol. Another coup lawyer sues the committee. And the Ukrainians destroy a large Russian warship as Biden announces new sanctions against Russia. I'm your host, Allison Gill. Hey, everybody. Big news day. Something's going on, just so you know, with Apple Podcasts. For some reason, the beans hasn't been showing up this week. The way that you fix that, from what we can tell so far, we do have a ticket in with Apple support. We don't know why it's happening, is you can unsubscribe and then resubscribe to the podcast, or unfollow and then refollow the podcast on Apple Podcasts. That should take care of your problem. Though I realize if you can't get the show, you can't hear this. So I guess we are Schrodinger's podcast today. But we do have a lot of news to get to. Later on in the show, I'm going to be talking with Hugo Lowell. He has some breaking news this morning about Steve Bannon's defense in his criminal contempt case. But we have some news and headlines to get to before that. So let's hit the hot notes. Hot notes. All right. First up, Ginny Thomas, a conservative activist married to Clarence Thomas, who's been missing for 7 days. Well, he's in the hospital. We know where he is. Repeatedly pressed White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows to pursue an unrelenting effort to overturn the 2020 presidential election in a series of urgent text exchanges in the weeks after the election. And that's according to copies of the messages obtained by The Washington Post and CBS News. 29 messages in all. They reveal an extraordinary pipeline between Ginny Thomas and Donald Trump's top aide during a period when Trump and his allies were vowing to go to the Supreme Court in an effort to negate the election results. On November 10th, after this 3 days after Biden was declared the winner, and after news organizations projected so, Thomas wrote to Meadows, "Help this great president stand firm. Help him, Mark. You are the leader with him who is standing for America's constitutional governance at the precipice. The majority knows Biden and the left is attempting the greatest heist of our history." When Meadows wrote to Thomas on November 24th, a couple weeks later, the White House chief of staff invoked God to describe the effort to overturn the election. Quote, "This is a fight for good versus evil," Meadows wrote. "Evil always looks like the victor until the King of Kings triumphs. Don't grow weary in well-doing. The fight continues. I have staked my career on it." Well, at least my time in D.C. on it. That was not smart. Thomas replied, "Thank you. Needed that. This plus a conversation with my best friend just now. I'll try to keep holding on. America's worth it." Don't know who her best friend is she's referring to there. The messages show, for the first time, how Ginny Thomas used her access to Trump's inner circle to promote and seek to guide the president's strategy to overturn the election results, and how receptive and grateful Mark Meadows said he was to receive her advice. Among Thomas's stated goals in the messages were for lawyer Sidney Powell to be the lead and the face of Trump's legal team. Meadows' attorney, George Terwilliger III, confirmed the existence of these 29 messages between his client, Mark Meadows, and Jenny Thomas. In reviewing the substance of the messages Wednesday, he said neither he nor Meadows would comment on individual texts, but nothing about these text messages presents any legal issues. Jenny Thomas did not respond to multiple requests for comment, and they tried to get Justice Thomas to comment by phone. You know, as I said, he's been hospitalized for 7 days now for treatment of an infection. He did not respond to a request for comment through the Supreme Court's pub. Now, in her text messages to Meadows, Jenny Thomas spread false theories, commented on cable news segments, and advocated with urgency and fervor that the president and his team take action to reverse the outcome of the election. She urged they take a hard line with Trump staffers and congressional Republicans who had resisted arguments that the election was stolen. The first of the 29 messages was sent November 5th, 2 days after the election, and she sent him a link to a YouTube video labeled Trump Sting with CIA Director Steve Pizenik, the biggest election story in history, QFS blockchain. Pizenik, former State Department official, is a far-right commentator who falsely claimed that the 2012 massacre at Sandy Hook was a false flag operation. Now, the video that Thomas shared with Meadows is no longer available on YouTube, but Thomas wrote, I hope this is true. Never heard anything like this before. Even a hint of it. Is it possible? So she's doing her own research, quote unquote. Quote, watermarked ballots in over 12 states have been part of a huge Trump and military white hat sting operation in 12 key battleground states, she texted. During that period, so you know, supporters of QAnon, the extremist ideology group, embraced a false theory that Trump had watermarked mail-in ballots so he could track potential fraud. Quote, watch the water was a refrain often repeated in QAnon circles at that time. And in that November 5th message to Meadows, Thomas went on to quote a passage that had circulated on right-wing websites. Quote, Biden crime family and ballot fraud co-conspirators, elected officials, bureaucrats, social media censorship mongers, fake stream media reporters, etc., are being arrested and detained for ballot fraud right now and over the coming days, and will be living in barges off Gitmo to face military tribunals for sedition. Wow, this is the wife of a Supreme Court justice, y'all. The next day, November 6th, Jenny Thomas sent a follow-up message. Do not concede. It takes time for the army who is gathering for his back. That's interesting, isn't it? Now, Meadows might not have been Thomas's only contact inside the Trump White House, especially that week. On November 13th, she texted Meadows about her outreach to Jared. I wonder if that's Jared Kushner, probably. She wrote, just forwarded your Gmail an email I sent Jared this morning. Sidney Powell and improved coordination now will help the cavalry come and fraud exposed and America saved. The messages provided to the House Select Committee do not show any response by Meadows. All right, so there's a lot more of these text messages, and you can check them out in my Twitter feed, at Mueller, she wrote, the Washington Post article. CNN broke the story first, but didn't have any of the content of the messages. And then Washington Post came out with the big story. Next up, from Hugo Lowell at The Guardian, the House Select Committee investigating January 6th attack will consider holding in criminal contempt of Congress next week two of Trump's most senior White House advisors, Dan Scavino and Peter Navarro. Scavino, Navarro, the stupid coups incorporated, I guess. And that is according to the January 6th panel. The move to initiate contempt proceedings against the two Trump aides amounts to a biting rebuke of their refusal to cooperate with the inquiry as the panel deploys its most punitive measures to reaffirm the consequences of noncompliance, which might run into a snag because these guys are executive branch employees. And I'm going to be talking with Hugo Lowell in a little bit about why that matters. Now, House investigators said in a notice it would consider a contempt report against Scavino and Navarro in a business meeting scheduled for Monday on Capitol Hill after they defied subpoenas, compelling them to testify and provide documents. The committee is expected to vote unanimously to send the contempt report for a vote to the full House of Representatives. That's according to a source from the panel or close to the panel. And the Select Committee took special interest in Scavino since Trump's former Deputy Chief of Staff for Communications was intimately involved in a months-long effort by the Trump White House to overturn the 2020 election results. Scavino was also closely involved in the scheme to pressure Mike Pence to stop the certification of Biden's election certification at that joint session of Congress. The Select Committee sought information from Navarro, since he knew of that scheme to have Pence return Trump to office, though his contacts with the former president and Trump war room at the Willard Hotel in Washington that oversaw it are still on the docket here. Navarro was briefed on the scheme, dubbed the Green Bay Sweep, by political operatives responsible for the operation at the Willard that included former Trump strategist Steve Bannon, who was also indicted for contempt last year for subpoena defiance. And we're going to get into that in a minute. The Guardian has reported that Trump discussed ways to stop Biden's certification from taking place with the Willard War Room hours before the Capitol attack, and that is from an exclusive from Hugo Lowell at The Guardian. However, the Select Committee's move to consider contempt reports against the two Trump aides indicate neither one complied with their subpoena. Their contempt reports are expected to be made public Sunday, and the move may indicate the committee has what they need on these guys, and they're done wasting time trying to negotiate with them. They're just going to refer them to the DOJ. There's a lot more detail, like I said, in this Guardian article. Please follow our friend Hugo Lowell on Twitter to get access to it, and consider supporting the Guardian for as little as a buck. That's really cheap, and you can, you know, do this from the inside the article. There's a link at the bottom of it, so I highly recommend that. In other committee news, Kurt Olson, an attorney who represented Texas in a lawsuit to overturn the election in 2020, has sued the January 6th committee in an effort to block them from compelling his testimony at a deposition and producing documents related to their investigation. It's unclear if the lawsuit, which was filed in D.C. federal court, will succeed, but it could delay the efforts to obtain his testimony. Olson, through his attorneys, also said the subpoena was invalid and unenforceable because it didn't allow for accommodations of his attorney-client relationship with former President Donald Trump and MyPillow guy Mike Lindell. Witnesses have filed more than 20 lawsuits to block subpoenas issued by the Select Committee because no one did anything wrong, obviously. I'm kidding. The Select panel took an interest in Olson's attempts to contact top Justice Department officials in last-ditch efforts to file an election challenge modeled after the Texas lawsuit, and also revealed he spoke with Trump several times on January 6th. Included in his subpoena, well, in the subpoena schedule, which is in his lawsuit that he filed, which showed the committee had asked him for documents related to conspiracy theories about the 2020 election, communications with the Justice Department officials about the election, and communications with Trump on January 6th. And that's among other documents. In a related story, the committee's investigation into the RNC via their vendor called Salesforce is expanding from fraudulent lies used to raise money to fraudulent lies used to raise money and incite violence. 1 hour before the rioters breached the police lines at the Capitol on January 6th, a fundraising email sent jointly by the Trump campaign and the RNC hit inboxes of thousands of supporters saying, "This is our last chance. It's time to fight back." The Hill's insurrection investigators say emails like this, which clogged the inboxes of Trump supporters, amount to a disinformation campaign that fueled the unrest that turned violent at the Capitol. And they want to know who at the RNC authored and approved these small dollar fundraising efforts, which helped raise millions on the false claim that then President Donald Trump's loss could be reversed. In a brief filed in the U.S. District Court in D.C. late Wednesday, the committee rejected the RNC's claim that the committee's bid for documents related to those post-election emails amount to a Democratic effort to obtain the opposing party's sensitive strategy details, which they're willing to fucking give away to the Kremlin. But we don't want you Americans coming after it. Sorry, I added that. Rather, the Select panel says it's singularly focused on the extent to which the RNC stoked and profited from Trump's election disinformation, plus any nexus their messaging had to the violence that followed. This is the first time we've heard reporting that they're looking at the nexus between these emails from the RNC used through Salesforce and the violent attack on the Capitol. The committee, I'm just calling it the committee from now on, opens their 57-page filing with, "In its motion for preliminary injunction, plaintiff Republican National Committee asked this court to prevent Salesforce from producing information sought by the committee to investigating the 1/6 attack on the Capitol." They go on to say this investigation is of the most deadly attack on the Capitol in our history. And through its subpoena to Salesforce, the Select Committee seeks information regarding whether and how the Trump campaign used Salesforce's platform to disseminate false statements about the 2020 election in the weeks leading up to the January 6th attack. Quote, "Contrary to the RNC's suggestion, the subpoena does not seek email content, individual specific info, nor any information about whether email recipients made financial contributions. Despite acknowledging that the January 6th attack was an attack on our country and its founding principles, the RNC asks this court to enjoin Salesforce from complying with the subpoena. For multiple reasons, the court should deny this extraordinary application." And then they list the reasons. Knuckle crack here. First, they say because of the speech or debate clause, the RNC can't use a civil action to interfere with the work of Congress. Second, oh, and by the way, I'm paraphrasing all this, just so you know. Their lawyers are much better writers. Second, even if you don't buy our speech or debate clause thing, the public interest outweighs the RNC's feelings. Third, the target dates of the data the committee wants is sufficiently focused to overcome any Fourth Amendment concerns. We're not in a fishing expedition, in other words. Fourth, the RNC's tantrum about the committee not having legislative purpose has been debunked by the courts a bunch. Fifth, the RNC contends we interpreted our own rules wrong for subpoenas, but we wrote the rules and we know what they are, and the RNC is being dumb. Sixth, the RNC's thoughts about our subpoena violating the Stored Records Act is stupid because it doesn't, and here's why. Seventh, the RNC has failed to demonstrate irreparable harm without an injunction, and even if it could, the public interest outweighs your SADs. And finally, the committee asked the court to skip the discovery phase, skip this whole trial thing, just go advance the trial on the merits and consolidate it with the next hearing. In fact, y'all should just dismiss this idiotic lawsuit brought by the RNC. Of course, like I said, I'm paraphrasing. Now, the subpoena they issued was actually issued to Salesforce, not the RNC. After the Capitol attack, Salesforce was like, we'll give it over. We're cool. They indicated in a public statement that it was concerned there was a connection between the RNC's email campaign and political violence that erupted on January 6th, just a couple of days earlier. It said it had taken action to ensure its platform could not be used that way again. And soon thereafter, the RNC announced it would no longer use Salesforce's platform for digital fundraising. Well, if we can't incite insurrections on your platform, you know, we're just going to have to go with someone else. Maybe Trump will start a new Truth Social email platform thing. Super successful. Quote, Salesforce has yet to publicly elaborate on the connection it saw between the use of its services and the violence on January 6th, or explain the actions it took, the panel wrote in its legal brief, filed by House General Counsel Doug Letter. But in investigating the connection that Salesforce saw between these fundraising emails and violence is critical to the Select Committee's work. And Donald Trump on Thursday sued his rival in the 2016 presidential election, Hillary Clinton, and everyone else in the universe, alleging they tried to rig the election by tying his campaign to Russia. And somehow I'm not mentioned in this lawsuit, and I got to say, I feel a little bit left out. I mean, he went through all the trouble of firing me from my government job after investigating my podcast about the Mueller investigation, but he's not suing me for trying to, you know, rig the election by tying his campaign to Russia. I guess my whole thing came out after the 2016 election. Anyway, the lawsuit covers a long list of grievances, and it's poorly written, and there's a lot of typos and grammatical errors. And the lawyer works out of a strip mall. I haven't read through the entire thing yet, but I'm going to be talking about it this weekend on Mueller, She Wrote. So you definitely want to listen to that on Sunday. And these are grievances that Trump has aired this whole time, these last 5 years, after beating Clinton. He won, by the way. So I don't know what damages he's possibly suing for. And it comes as he continues to falsely claim that his 2020 election defeat by Democratic President Joe Biden was the result of widespread fraud. Now, acting in concert, quote, the defendants maliciously conspired to weave a false narrative that their Republican opponent, Donald J. Trump, was colluding with a hostile foreign sovereignty. Interesting that he refers to Russia as a hostile foreign sovereignty now. The former president alleges this in his 108-page lawsuit. It also alleges racketeering and conspiracy to commit injurious falsehoods. The suit seeks compensatory and punitive damages. Trump said he was forced to incur expenses in an amount to be determined at trial, but known to be in excess of $24 million, and continuing to accrue in the form of defense costs, legal fees, and related expenses. Kind of omitting the part where the RNC is paying his legal bills and he's duping his base for money. But let me just read you the list of defendants. Again, I'm sad I'm not on here. But Hillary Clinton, HFACC Inc., Democratic National Committee, DNC Services Corporation, Perkins Coie, Michael Sussman, who was a lawyer for Perkins Coie. He's the guy that Durham indicted. Mark Elias, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, Charles Halliday, Dolan Jr., Jake Sullivan, John Podesta, Robert Mook, Philip Raines, Fusion GPS, remember them? Glenn Simpson and Peter Fritsch, they're Fusion GPS. They're Nellie Orr and Bruce Orr. Orbis Business Intelligence and Christopher Steele, that's kind of one thing. Igor Danchenko. He's one of the guys who was also indicted by Durham. New Star Inc. Rodney Jaffe. Rodney Jaffe is the tech executive that Michael Sussman was representing. James Comey, Pete Strzok, Lisa Page, Kevin Kleinsmith. That's the guy who altered an email in the Carter Page thing, and Andrew McCabe. And then a bunch of other John Does. Maybe I'm in the Does. Maybe I'm a Jane Doe. Probably not. And in international news, Ukrainian armed forces say they destroyed a large Russian landing ship at a port in southern Ukraine on Thursday. The port, which had recently been occupied by Russian forces with several Russian warships, was rocked by a series of heavy explosions soon after dawn. Social media videos show fire raging at the dockside with a series of secondary explosions reverberating across the city. The Ukrainian armed forces say that besides destroying the Orsk, which is what they've called the ship, two more ships were damaged. Quote, a 3,000-ton fuel tank was also destroyed. The fire spread to the enemy's ammunition depot. Details of the damage inflicted on the occupier are being clarified. So it sounds like they made a pretty good hit if they got near the fuel tank, the 3,000-ton fuel tank, and the ammunitions depot. That's where you want to aim for to do the most damage. It's not known what weapon was used to attack the port. But in other Russia news here, the United States has hit Russia with a new round of sanctions on Thursday, targeting more than 300 members of Duma, its parliament, and dozens of defense companies, while moving to restrict Russia's ability to use its gold reserves to prop up its currency, because that's what they were kind of scrambling to do. The actions, which came in conjunction with new sanctions from Western allies, were the latest attempts to inflict economic pain on President Putin of Russia for his invasion of Ukraine. In addition to imposing new sanctions, the U.S. move to curtail Russia's ability to evade existing restrictions on its central bank and major financial institutions, because there had been concerns that Russia was finding ways to stabilize the ruble and rebuild its currency reserves. The sanctions were announced as Biden met with world leaders at a summit in Brussels focused on the war in Ukraine. New sanctions target 328 members of the State Duma, the lower house of Russia's Federal Assembly. They also include Russian defense companies such as Tactical Missiles Corporation, JSC, which makes weapons systems. As part of the effort to put financial pressure on Putin's allies, the U.S. said it was sanctioning Erman Greff, the president and chairman of Sberbank. That's one of Russia's largest banks. We already imposed sanctions on Sberbank last month. The Treasury Department is taking aim at alternative assets that Russia could use to support its economy and issued new guidance on Thursday to make clear that transactions involving Russia's $130 billion of gold reserves were also subject to U.S. sanctions. Russia built up its gold war chest in recent years to help blunt the impact of sanctions by allowing its central bank to use the precious metal to buy currency on secure loans. Nope, not anymore. The U.S. is working to close that loophole by threatening sanctions on anyone that facilitates such transactions. The Treasury Department guidance says anyone determined to be responsible for or complicit in or have directly or indirectly engaged and attempted to engage in the circumventing of sanctions, including through assets like gold. Don't. All right. That is the regular news for today. Stick around. We're going to be right back with Hugo Lowell and this breaking news on the Bannon defense for his criminal contempt indictment. And we'll talk a little bit about Scavino, Navarro, and Stupid Coups Incorporated. Stick around. We'll be right back.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
Jon Stewart is back in the host chair at The Daily Show, which means he's also back in our ears on The Daily Show Ears Edition podcast. The Daily Show podcast has everything you need to stay on top of today's news and pop culture. You get hilarious, satirical takes on entertainment, politics, sports, and more from Jon and the team of correspondents and contributors. The podcast also has content you can't get anywhere else, like extended interviews and a roundup of the weekly headlines. Listen to The Daily Show, Ears Edition, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I am joined today by congressional reporter for The Guardian, Hugo Lowell. Hi, Hugo. How are you?
Hi, I'm good. Thanks.
Good. Hey, question for you, because you have some breaking news about Steve Bannon's defense against his criminal contempt indictment. And let me see if I have this right, because it took me a minute to get my head around it. His defense, him and his lawyer, I think, are saying that the Department of Justice has an old Office of Legal Counsel memo saying that executive branch employees get to have a lawyer present during congressional questioning. And they say that the 1-6 committee didn't allow him to have his lawyer there. And even though Bannon is not an executive branch employee, Donald Trump is. And since they wanted to ask about Bannon's chats with Donald Trump, then the OLC memo covers him by proxy, I guess. Do I sort of have that right?
Yeah, I'd say almost. So, yeah, it is complicated. And it's necessarily complicated because the way this has come about is Bannon has obviously defied his subpoena and he's now being held in contempt. And now he's trying to find reasons that would fit in nicely with, you know, common legal defenses for this kind of thing. And this is why it's kind of complicated, is because he's trying to shoehorn it into existing defenses. But right, the crux of this is basically that he reasonably believed, on the advice of counsel, his then counsel, Bob Costello, who told him the committee subpoena was invalid because the committee, in its rules, has this provision that says no third party lawyers can be present in a deposition, and it's House deposition rules. And because you can't have a third party lawyer, that means, according to Bannon and his legal team, he couldn't have a Trump lawyer present to adjudicate question by question what matters were covered by executive privilege and what matters were not. And the 2019 Office of Legal Counsel memo you referenced say that executive branch employees need to be able to have, or must have, an executive branch counsel present in the depositions to do just that, to protect like president's constitutional authority to protect their conversations with aides. Otherwise, the subpoena is legally invalid and not criminally or civilly enforceable. And on this 2019 OLC memo that he's relying to say, well, the entire subpoena is invalid. And even though the OLC subpoena, the OLC memo says executive branch employees, he argues it also covers former employees.
And I take it that, and from what you've written here also, that, you know, the committee is saying, but Biden, first of all, Biden waived privilege. Second of all, why didn't Bannon's lawyer bring this up earlier? And that sort of moots this late argument. And again, Bannon is not an executive branch employee. And I don't think we have any precedent. Because, back in the old Nixon versus GSA times, that was different. It didn't include executive branch, executive privilege discussions with the president. Or there's a previous case they cited. Maybe it's not Nixon versus GSA. I might have read too many legal briefings today. But they have a lot of arguments against this. And I honestly, looking at all the information you've got in here, I think it will probably fail. But maybe that's not the point of this defense.
Yeah. So the point with all these OLC memos, so Bannon's basically saying the subpoena was invalid because OLC memos say so. And the reason why that 2019 OLC memo applies to me or protects me is because of other OLC opinions. And, his lawyer told me, we're reading these OLC opinions together. So just because the 2019 one specifically refers to, executive branch employees and technically, quote, agency counsel, it doesn't mean that the principle doesn't carry over, and the principle at the heart of all of this is presidents need to be able to have candid conversations with their aides. And, subpoenas, congressional subpoenas that don't honor or don't allow the privilege holders' counsel to attend that deposition are invalid. So, he's got the Nixon versus GSA thing that says, Trump's invocation of executive privilege was valid because it's, the Nixon case says former presidents can invoke executive privilege. And there's a separate OLC opinion that says, well, it doesn't have to be just current employees of the executive branch. Executive privilege can extend to private advisors, like non-White House employees or former White House employees as well. And so he's using all these OLC memos together to say, well, okay, actually, I have a legal defense. And it's not clear whether they will succeed. In fact, he may not succeed. But as you suggest, what it seems like where this is going is he will lose at this level, but he will then appeal it to the DC circuit, which is where all the current case law precedents are. And without getting too technical, the precedents that is at issue here is this case from, I think it was 1961, Licavoli versus the United States. And the Licavoli court held that what Bannon is saying, effectively that he relied on his counsel's advice that the subpoena was invalid, can't be used as a defense, because advice of counsel is not a defense. Ignorance of the law is no defense. But Bannon's lawyers are saying the Licavoli case doesn't actually apply to him, because Licavoli, who was actually like a mob boss, if I remember correctly, and he just refused to show up to Congress to testify, there was no executive privilege issue with his subpoena, but there is for Bannon. And where this is all going is this interpretation of the words willful default, because that's the technical language in the contempt of Congress statute. Bannon's lawyers are saying the willful default interpretation should be that Bannon thought there was nothing unlawful or wrong when he defied the subpoena. The Justice Department is saying, no, that's not correct. You should look at the Licavoli precedent, which says willfully default means simply that there was a deliberate effort not to comply with the subpoena. So I hope that's not too complicated, but it is a complex
situation. No, it makes sense, because it's, you know, you get stuck in the weeds a little bit, and I feel like he's trying to argue why he doesn't need to show up for a deposition, when actually what he's arguing is that he had a reasonable belief that he didn't have to, based on what his counsel was saying, and what the DOJ is arguing is based on a case that doesn't include a president, so executive privilege doesn't apply.
Right.
And I got to be honest with you, I've read a lot of really dumb legal defenses in the past few years. This one actually isn't bad. I still think it'll fail. But like you said, I think that the purpose here is delay. Delay is the name of the game. And I mean, it's as good as any defense that I would have, you know, been able to come up with. Of course, I'm not a lawyer. But it's interesting that they're kind of using these Office of Legal Counsel memos like in tandem, and saying that your case law doesn't apply because it doesn't include a president.
Right. And these ORC, and they're using the ORC memos deliberately, because, you know, part of the argument is, look, these ORC memos drafted by the Office of Legal Counsel, they are the lawyers for the Attorney General. And there is a long held belief, in fact, you know, custom and practice at the Justice Department, that ORC memos are binding on the executive branch, which obviously includes the DOJ. And if a DOJ memo, an ORC memo, says a subpoena that is invalid is not criminally or civilly enforceable, then Bannon's lawyers are saying, well, that in itself should mean the DOJ should have to drop the case, because their own internal department policies are saying it's invalid and can't be prosecuted. And like, they're relying on this estoppel defense as well. It's like this multi-part thing. He's basically drawing on little parts of several ORC memos and cobbling them together for a wider legal defense. And I talked to an ex-ORC attorney advisor about this, and he thought it was a really interesting way to go. And it, you know, really is going to cause a little bit of a problem here for the DOJ, especially maybe at the DC circuit level.
Yeah, I could imagine that it would, although the attorney general can get a new or overridden Office of Legal Counsel memo. To say,
but
okay,
Bannon's
saying
basically I have to rely on what was available to me at the time, and the DOJ memos that are available to me at the time suggested that a subpoena of this nature was invalid, and therefore Bannon's saying, well, I was relying on my lawyer's interpretation of the ORC memo because they're so complicated, and as a layman I couldn't possibly understand. And so this is where we're back again with Bannon.
Yeah, and did they have a specific argument against the committee argument that Biden waived executive privilege? So all what you're saying is moot.
So I went back and checked this, and spoiler alert for some of the people listening. So in the time that I sent you snippets of this, and now, I went and checked with the White House, and I'm not certain that the White House did waive executive privilege. In this instance, they did waive executive privilege on Trump's communication in general in the National Archives case, but it's not clear actually that they waived executive privilege with respect to Bannon specifically. In fact, because there is that letter from Trump that said, I assert executive privilege. I don't think there was a formal rebuttal from Biden or Dana Remus, the White House counsel, to say, actually, we waive that specific privilege that Trump is invoking. But the general point is, yes, the Select Committee has said that, you know, we don't think Trump has actually asserted executive privilege. And so at base, the case for the committee and for the DOJ is that there was no invocation of executive privilege.
Yeah, or the remedy could be if there was invocation, you know, the court could say Biden would say,
yeah, exactly.
You know,
yes. Exactly. Yes.
But, you know, like I said, I think this is a delay tactic, but not a bad defense for the kind of dumb shits that I'm used to seeing on the side of the aisle. Now, my first thought when I read your story was, well, no wonder it's taking so long to indict Meadows, because he actually is an executive branch employee.
Right. Yeah. The problem with this is Bannon was not an executive branch employee at the time, and he, the invocations of this executive privilege may or may not be clear. With Meadows, it's a lot more clear, right? Like, Meadows was actually the White House chief of staff at the time of the communications, and so if there was ever an OLC memo that applies, it would be that 2019 memo, and it would apply squarely on top of Meadows. And so if they end up having a lot of trouble with the Bannon case, the experts I talked to thought it would chill the DOJ's case with Meadows, and it could also chill the case, or the case that we expect to come proceeding starting on Monday with contempt against Scavino and Navarro, who are both also White House employees and executive branch employees. And so Bannon's case is actually quite crucial, like beyond just himself and the Select Committee, but also for future congressional probes of the executive branch.
Do you know what, when you were doing your research, and I'll look this up too if we don't have an answer, but what was that 2019 OLC memo originally about in response to?
Oh, I have to dig it up. I don't immediately remember. It's public though. You can look it up. It's
right.
It was basically about, and it was very, very, it was a very narrow opinion that specifically dealt with I think it was an EPA actually. I think it was an EPA. Congress wanted an EPA official to testify. And again, I think it was the same thing with House deposition rules, didn't allow a EPA agency attorney to be present for the deposition. And the OLC said that was legally invalid, or the subpoena was legally invalid for that reason.
Interesting. That's very interesting, because if it was a very narrow memo and it did only apply to that EPA person testifying, then that would be another argument that the 1-6 committee could use to apply it here, or to Meadows, or to Scavino or Navarro. But I mean, it's still an argument. So I don't know. We'll see what happens. And one last question before I let you go. We had talked earlier about the difference in the rules between a deposition and a written interview. Weren't there some people who were referred for contempt, or were thinking about being referred for contempt, or weren't referred for contempt, perhaps because they had an interview and not a transcript in an interview instead of an actual deposition?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So the question was about Rosen and Donahue. And basically, Rosen and Donahue, these two Trump DOJ officials, had an appearance before the committee. It's not clear whether they had a deposition or if they had a transcribed interview. But the fact of the matter was, DOJ counsel were allowed to attend that interview to say, you know, what they could testify about, what they couldn't testify about. And so it raises the question of, well, you know, fine, if it wasn't a deposition, that's all well and good. But if that's the case, why couldn't they do the same for Bannon? If all they wanted was his information, the fact that they pursued a deposition only and, you know, didn't want to negotiate, you know, both sides didn't want to negotiate, but if they didn't want to negotiate about any other circumstance under which he could testify or talk to the committee, then Bannon might argue they were just trying to set him up.
Yeah, and I did notice that when the 1-6 committee filed that huge, you know, 8-7 reasons why privilege doesn't apply to John Eastman and his emails, they had included some transcripts of Rosen and Donahue interviews. And I noticed that there were Department of Justice lawyers there. And my first thought was, ooh, the Department of Justice is investigating. And then I realized, no, you probably have to have a Department of Justice lawyer present when you're questioning former Department of Justice employees. I was really excited for about 3 seconds and then took myself down a notch. Anyway, thank you so much for coming on and explaining this to us. It's an incredible story. And I look forward to perhaps getting some more information from some folks about maybe why this could put a kibosh on a Meadows or a Scavino or a Navarro indictment. And although, you know, I find it interesting that the committee would go ahead and continue to subpoena executive branch employees without talking to the DOJ about their 2019 memo, or without a Meadows indictment?
Yeah, well, I guess we're just going to have to see. I'm going to rush because Capitol Police is throwing me out of the basement. But yes, that is a good point as well.
All right. Yeah, I don't want you to get in trouble with the Capitol Police. Have a good day. Thanks so much, Hugo. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Bye.
Everybody, stick around. We'll be right back with the good news.
After these messages, we'll be right back.
All right, everybody, welcome back. It's time for the good news.
Who likes good news, everyone? Then good news, everyone.
Whatever you want to send us, Whoopi stories, please send them to us at dailybeanspod.com and click on contact. And again, if you're having trouble with Apple Podcasts not updating the Beans feed, try unfollowing and then following again. This has worked for everyone who was missing episodes. First up from Kristen, pronouns she and her. Greetings, beautiful Beans queens. This isn't really a correction as much as an excuse to send more pictures of my dog. I'm writing in response to Dana's comment regarding the listener who wrote in and stated it was the first time he was listing preferred pronouns. While Dana may be correct that this listener had recently accomplished a significant transformation of some kind, I just wanted to comment that as a cisgender heteronormative white person, it seemed like a big deal to me a couple years ago when I added my preferred pronouns to my email signature. I realized that a cishet perspective experience does little to support the lives of any of our marginalized siblings. Just making the point that many of us who never really had to define ourselves are finally recognizing these truths and trying to be better humans. I recently sent a photo of Lily, our 8-year-old mini Aussie. I love mini Aussies. Here are some better pics that show her light blue eyes. Lily's right eye is marbled with brown pigmentation in the upper iris. Not a lazy eye. It's as cute as a cute little kid once said. Oh, yeah, I could see how they might think that. How awesome. What a beautiful baby. And I love how the blue in the eyes matches the blue in the coat, you know? They're just so beautiful, these coats. She looks very serious. Adorable. Thank you. Thank you so much for that submission, Kristen. I appreciate it. All right, next up from Rachel, pronouns she and her. New time listener and soon to be newly graduated nurse. I started my journey to become a nurse 7 years ago, straight out of high school. But life took some interesting turns. It usually does, Rachel. But long story short, I will graduate this May with my BSN and MSN. Nice. Will sit for my state boards and start my new job I was hired for in the ICU. Ooh, ICU nurse. That is awesome. While nursing is a scary place right now, I hope to make some good trouble in my hopefully long career. Rachel, ICU nurses are badass. Congratulations. Rachel says, below is my pet tax of my cousin's dog running, multiple dogs running on their farm and being goofballs. And not seen are the cousin's horses walking back to the barn for feeding time. Oh, dude. The jumping dog in the middle is my favorite. Look at the one on the left. Okay. These are goofballs. I love these dogs. Thank you for sending that in. Next submission from Brent, pronouns he and him. Hey, Beans Queens and fellow Leguminati. It's me, Brent. I'd like to put in my application to be the official independent dark fantasy horror and sci-fi author of the Daily Beans. Apologies if that designation has already been claimed. You've asked for people to share their arts and crafts. Well, my art is writing books. I have 6 books so far. The first three are an ongoing series about my pal Chuggy. He's basically a very drunk Tom Waits stumbling around a world of strange monsters and getting into trouble. I have a young adult comedy horror called Keep Away from Psycho Joe that takes place in rural northern Wisconsin. I have a future sports sci-fi horror called Cruise Roosters that comes with all the trigger warnings. That one follows a young female sportscaster who has caught the eye of the nation's tyrant, a ranting orange buffoon named Prophet King. Wonder who that's named after. It's harrowing and brutal, but at its core, it's a plea for unity. And lastly, I have a short story called Doomsday Furnace that's just a whimsical frolic from front cover to back. You can find me on Amazon if you search for Brent Michael Kelly, K-E-L-L-E-Y. I wrote these stories to share them with readers, not to get rich. So I'm happy to send folks ebooks at no charge. Please support independent authors and publishers. There's so many great voices at small presses that people just don't know about. Lastly, wish me luck as I try to make myself a full-time author this year. Awesome. Love you guys. Love this community. All right, I'm going to head out. Okay. This photo is amazing. The mustache is amazing. The Chinese crested is amazing. The leather coat is amazing. The top hat is amazing. Or is that a stove? No, it's a top hat. This is so great. Thank you, Brent. I appreciate this. Next up from Ellen of Hey Poopy Podcast. Yes. Pronouns she and her. Hello, amazing leaders of the beans. I have an Easter story. It's of me as a child, probably around 5 years old. My mother left out my Easter basket overnight for me to find the next day. When I came down to see what the bunny left in the basket, I also saw a pile of poop next to it. One of our Medi cats pooped right next to my Easter basket. Later that day, we went to dinner and a bunch of older family friends asked me if the bunny came. And I said with great pride, yes, and he pooped. And the Hey Poopy Podcast was born. I added that part. These older ladies weren't as excited about it as I was. I've attached an Easter photo of my dog, Sophia, 92-pound pit mastiff, whew, as a pet tax. Plus, March is Colorectal Cancer Awareness Month, reminding everyone over 45 to get a colonoscopy. To raise awareness this month, my co-host, some of our past guests, and I made butt prints, which we're auctioning off to raise money for CRC awareness. Check them out at heypoopypodcast.com. Thank you for being so amazing. I got my colonoscopy. The prep is a little meh, but all in all, I had a good time. The fentanyl was wonderful. I got to watch the whole thing on a giant screen TV. It was like a weird roller coaster through my butt. And the recovery was fine. I think I'd never been in a fentanyl twilight sleep before. And I have to say, I enjoyed it. It was just like, I was pretty high. And I don't know if you do this when you're high, especially if you're around doctors or somebody who you think, you know, is a respectable profession. But I was talking a lot and I was like, woo, this is crazy. But then I would just remind everyone, hey, I'm high right now. That's why I'm like this. It was kind of funny. Oh, look at this dog, this mastiff mix with the bunny ears. What a precious baby. I bet this dog just like jumps on your lap because they think that they're a lap dog. So adorable. All right. And finally, from Chelsea, pronouns she, her. Hello, beans ladies. I've been listening since the kitchen days. And I start my day listening to you every day. Thank you, Chelsea. I'm so grateful for your insight and your humor. And of course, the swearing. Fuck yeah. I have a good news story. About 3 weeks ago, our cat, Hattie, got real sick. She's 19, and she has to be the best cat I've ever had. I had to take her to the emergency vet hospital on Sunday at like 10 p.m. They told me she has pancreatitis and that she needed to stay in the hospital for like a week with a very guarded prognosis for $5,000, or they could euthanize her. Well, we didn't have $5,000, and I didn't want them to put her to sleep. You see, the hospital won't let me come in due to COVID, and the thought of her dying with strangers was unbearable for me. I agree with that, Chelsea. I asked that they give her some fluids and pain meds. My plan was to take her home and have our regular vet put her down the next day. This is the good news part. The next morning, she started purring. We went to our vet for the first thing, and to our surprise, our vet said she thought we could treat her. The vet taught me how to give her fluids at home. We did some meds, and within 2 days, she was doing amazing. She's now not only better, she is like a new woman. Other issues she had are gone, too. It's a miracle. I'm so glad we have more time with her. Always trust your gut. Photo of Hattie attached for your pet tax. Oh, hi, Hattie. Oh, she's beautiful. I really like that. I like your pillowcases and your bedspread, too. But all eyes on Hattie. What a beauty. Oh, I was so scared when I just took recently. I had to take boobs in to get some teeth pulled. And he's 15. I just hate to put him under general anesthesia, you know? But he's fine. He's tomorrow's his last day of antibiotics and gabapentin, so he doesn't have to keep taking pain meds. But he's the happy cat. He's purring, very, very happy. And he's a little bit better off than he was. So I feel this very hard. So congrats on Hattie. And everyone, thanks for sending in your submissions. I love the good news segments. If you have any good news you want to send in, you can do that by going to dailybeanspod.com and clicking on contact. And thanks again to our patrons. We love you. All right, I got to head out of here. I am about to appear on the Mary Trump podcast, Mary Trump Show. So I will see you there, and then I will see you again this weekend. Until then, please take care of yourselves, take care of each other, take care of the planet, take care of your mental health, and vote blue over Q. I've been AG, and them's the beans.
Refried beans. I like refried.
Hi, this is John Cryer, and I am hosting a new 7-part true crime podcast called Lawyers, Guns, and Money. That'll challenge everything you think you know about U.S. covert operations and presidential misconduct. From Jack Bryan, the director of American PSYOP, comes the incredible true story of John Mattis, a newly sworn-in Miami public defender in the 1980s who has found himself completely in over his head.
I step off the plane, and there is a van with a couple guys with Uzis. And one of them in broken English said, "Welcome to Bogota, John."
Mattis's first felony defendant has been arrested for having a machine gun and tells Mattis a dangerous secret.
He was shipping arms into Central America on behalf of the CIA. As a first-time lawyer, I want to act like I know what I'm doing.
But with the help of a Colombian drug smuggler...
How much money the CIA raised by hitting up drug dealers?
A lot of money, millions of dollars.
An Alabama mercenary...
They were prepared to die to the last man. I saw this in them. I saw the fire in their eyes. And they made me their war chief.
And a newly elected senator, John Kerry.
We are looking at allegations of drug running, gun smuggling, conspiracy to commit murder and murder itself.
He'll fight to free his client.
The judge said, "Show me in a courtroom how we were at war."
Expose an illegal war being run by the White House.
I mean, I wanted him involved, but I didn't want to be on record as doing it.
And somehow stay alive in the process.
I just escaped a kidnapping by the CIA in Costa Rica.
This is Lawyers, Guns, and Money.
So you have a man in an Armani suit standing in the bow of a boat with a rocket launcher and says, "If I lose sight of you, I will launch. You will be vaporized."
Available everywhere starting October 29th, or get it ad-free and early starting October 22nd at lawyersgunsandmoney.supercast.com. There you'll find bonus episodes along with exclusive content. Subscribe now.